Hey gang, welcome to the Gale Athletics Connections podcast, the show that brings you the men and women of track and field and explores their unique stories. The show is brought to you by Gale Athletics. Head on over to galeathletics.com to find all your track and field equipment needs. I'm your host, Mike Cunningham, National Sales Manager for Gale. And this episode, our guest is Ashland University Head Coach Judd Logan. Really have been working hard these past few weeks to get Judd on the show, really to talk about his culture that he has grown and cultivated there at Ashland University. We get to talk about just how he started at Ashland, what culture meant to him, really learned a lot about his old coach, Al Schotterman. What an amazing mentor he had to learn the importance of culture as it relates to track and field excellence, really. Also get a quick health update. You'll be glad to hear things are going in the right direction. So without further ado, please help me welcome the wise, the wonderful Judd Logan. I got throwers on the brain here. Today we have Judd Logan on the podcast. Judd, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for finally getting this together with me. I know we had to clear a lot of stuff through compliance. There's a lot of stuff in this COVID time that has people worried about their jobs and whether they're allowed to say what they want to say. So let's get through this thing.
Hey man, it was worth it. The back and forth and the scheduling and rescheduling, it was worth it to get you on the podcast. So if you don't know Judd, every credential you can think of, four-time Olympian. I looked it up. There has not been many Americans in track and field that have hit four Olympics. This is a very small elite club that you're in here. And then former American record holder. And interestingly, that Lance Deal actually broke your American record in the hammer.
I was there when he did it. It was 1994 in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I was a fan of the sport. I was retired at the time and hadn't really thought about making a comeback. But I was at Knoxville when Lance broke the record. And as he hit it, I put my hands up into the air and I acknowledged him. And he looked at me, put his hand on his heart, and he bowed. And it was a nice moment between the two of us because we were great competitors, but we were better friends.
That's respect right there.
Yes.
So I thought it was really funny near the end of Lance's interview. I told him, you know, from what I know of, and you know him better than I do, you know, what a great guy, very selfless, that, you know, he wants to see his American record broken one day because that's moving the sport forward. And he shut me down. He goes, no, I'm very selfish. I don't ever want anybody to break my record. Is that how you felt? Or it seems like you kind of were like, you knew it was passing the torch a little bit.
In the moment, of course, I didn't want anybody to break it. Between the weight throw and the hammer throw, I broke the American record 13 times. I had it for a day. And Bill Green from out in California broke it the day after I broke it at the Jesse Owens meet. And so, you know, you understand that that's fleeting. For me, it was very important. I wanted to be the first American to ever throw 80 meters. Mm. And that was a huge moment for me. That happened at Mount SAC in 1986. That got me the cover of Track and Field News. And so that was a special moment because that was something I was pursuing even more than the American record. Mm-hmm. I eventually went to Penn State in 1988 in a low-level meet, and everything came together, and I threw 81-88, which was the final American record, 268 feet, 8 inches. I think Nate was 5 years old at the time, my son, and we had taken him over there with us, and you can hear him yell in the background when I let it go. So fabulous memories. Luke McKay at Penn State took me over, and he goes, I want to see the circle you threw out of because we haven't removed any. We don't throw here anymore, but I took him down. The circle's still there. The cage is still there, but they train down at the other end at a brand new area of land that they have. But that was really cool for me to kind of go out there with Luke and take a look around and remember that memory of 81, 88.
Could you visualize, could you see the video playing while you were in the ring?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, total recall. I remember in round five, it started raining. And there's a throw on video somewhere. Well, Rob LaSorsa has the American record throw that he's put up on Twitter before. But in round five, my glove got wet and I lost the throw about 15 feet outside the sector to the right, a little over 270 feet because my glove was wet. And the thing about that, Mike, is when I got back after that meet, I said to my training partners, I said, I've got this thing figured out. I don't think I'll ever throw under 80 meters again in a competition. And I didn't do it till 4 years later.
You didn't throw under 80?
No, I didn't throw over 80 again.
Oh!
That's how difficult it is. That's how difficult it is. I came home from that meet and over the course of the next couple months made every mistake an athlete who's coaching himself can make, from overtraining to overcaffeinating to not wanting to drop distance in practice to pushing it in the weight room to start doing new things I'd never done before. And next thing you know, I've got an iliotibial band problem in my hip, IT band. I ended up after Seoul, Korea, having to have surgery, which cost me 5 months. So I learned a lot from that process. And, you know, my whole career as a thrower, I did not know at the time, set me up to be a coach. Because I always tell my kids, I said, look, I've made every mistake that you can possibly make. I've been coached by Stuart Toger. I've been coached by Harold Conley. I've been coached by Al Schotterman. I've been coached by the greats. I've trained with Sadiq, Tam, Litvinov, Bondarchuk. But I've made enough mistakes on my own that I'm going to be able to save you from 70 to 80% of the mistakes that I made as an athlete, because I only got you for 4 years and possibly five if you redshirt. So we're talking over a career of 15, 18 years that I learned all of this stuff. So, you know, at that time, I never wanted to be a coach. I wanted to do radio and TV. I wanted to do broadcasting. I actually turned down a job with ESPN in 1984 to train for the Olympic trials because my coach, Al Schotterman, believed that I had a great shot to make the team, but I had to turn down that job that was going to pay me $16,000 a year and eventually maybe get me on TV on a cable network that wasn't even in the state of Ohio yet. So I've had a lot of things happen in my life that I didn't know the reason they were all happening, but they all made me the person that I am and led me to, when I started at Ashland, to develop the culture that we have here.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we want you on the podcast. We are going to talk about culture for anybody who has been on the outside looking in at Ashland, whether it's through social media videos or maybe you competed against one of the athletes or one of the coaches even. It is undeniable there is a unique culture that happens in Ashland, Ohio. Before we get there, I know people listening right now are they know about your health issues and things like that. And if you don't, you know, Judd, as a head coach of a big time Division II program here, don't be fooled just because it's only, and I'm doing air quotes here, Division II, big time program here, always battling for conference and national championships. Well, I'm going to let you tell the story, Judd. Why don't you give us a synopsis of the story and an update on how things are going?
Sure. In 2019, I was diagnosed with B-cell ALL leukemia, and it was a punch in the gut because they had pretty much ruled out the cancers and were focusing on another area that was causing my platelets to drop so low. But when I got that diagnosis, my daughter, who just happened to be a nurse practitioner in oncology, made some phone calls and got me into the best care that I could possibly get over at the Cleveland Clinic. And we started a regimen. We started a clinical trial. And I had to pass three big hoops to be allowed in this trial. You couldn't be over the age of 60 to get in the trial. I was 59 and a half.
Oh.
I had to have a certain chromosome. And it wasn't bad or good. You just had to have this chromosome to be allowed in the study. And I had it. And then there was one other hoop that I had to jump through. But we got in this clinical trial. I've got an incredible leukemia doctor. And we started treating this thing. And almost immediately, I started having fantastic results. Unfortunately, I had to miss the 2019 Indoor NCAA Championships, where in 25 years of coaching, 15 years as head coaching, we've been second three times, we've been third four times, we've been fourth five times, and we win the national championship. I miss the confetti cannon. I don't get to touch the gold, but you know, I watched that whole thing on the live feed, and you know, saw my team get on the podium, and you know, obviously, you know, raised my spirits, and you know, moving forward, I got to be part of the outdoor team, and we traveled to Texas, and going into the final day, we were behind Angelo State by 26 points. And on paper, they were supposed to just run away with this thing. They have somebody false start in one of the hurdles. Miles Pringle gets into the 200 because there is a disqualification. He gets moved up and gets fourth. And then Trevor Bassett comes and wins the 400 hurdles. Alex Hill exceeds his mark in the discus. And next thing you know, we're going to the 4x4 with a chance to lock down second. And if Angelo falters at all in the 4x4, we got a chance to win this thing. So they announce on the loudspeaker that Angelo's lining up for the 4x4, that they've never finished outside the top five in the last 10 years in the 4x4. Well, that's not something you want to hear.
You're right.
even if we won it, we couldn't win it. We couldn't win the title. And you know, they knew that, and their guys went out and they just kind of overdid it. They went like it was a 4x300 and they kept dying in the last 100. And we moved up into second behind who was it? George Williams's team.
St.
Augustine. Yeah. And you know, we end up running 308 for second place. And they get seventh or eighth, and we're national champions by 1 point.
No,
we won the indoor by 1 point. Yeah, we won the indoor by 1 point. We won the outdoor by 1 point. And I got to be there for that confetti cannon. I got to be there for that moment. But in April, late April of last year, 19, I was diagnosed with remission, meaning that they had done a bone marrow biopsy, they had done a interthecal lumbar puncture, and they couldn't find any leukemia, which means that I was in remission. And that means that it doesn't mean the cancer's gone or it's not coming back. There's just no more mature cells. So I've been on that process now, and I'm 14 months in remission, and I am on my last cycle of chemotherapy. I'm hooked up right now. I've got a 28-day, I got a 28-day fanny pack on. I'm on a drug called blinatumomab that's, you know, hooked up to my port. And when that finishes, I will then be tested again for bone marrow biopsy, for lumbar punctures to make sure I'm still 0.00. And then I move into an 18-month maintenance phase where I only have to go in every 3 months for a little bit of treatment. And hopefully we've got this thing cooked. But I just never envisioned getting to that last cycle of this 18-month clinical trial. And that's going to come to an end here sometime in June.
Oh, man, that's the best news you could hear.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
Absolutely.
Oh, man.
The only better news that I could get is that schools are opening up and I get my kids back and I have an opportunity to safely get out and start coaching some kids, maybe starting off in some smaller groups. But, you know, I'm not going to lie to you, Mike. I've enjoyed a little bit of the downtime. I think any coach that tells you they haven't enjoyed a little bit of the downtime is lying to you, because it's such a stressor to, you know, we do more than coach with our kids. You know, I probably do more from 7 to 9 o'clock at night on my text messaging with kids and, you know, putting out fires and talking about practices than I ever do during what people consider coaching hours. So yeah. there's no 40-hour week in a coach. And to think that we don't need that downtime and we don't need to recharge that battery, I'm not Superman. And I'm in a really good place right now where I'm done. I want my kids back. I want to start doing what I love. I want to start building. We're still the defending national champions. I know that I've got to take care of my health. As someone who's been diagnosed with leukemia, I have what's considered a compromised immune system. So, I don't go to the grocery store. I don't go to patios. I don't go where there's a lot of people. My wife has done an incredible job of isolating me, making sure people are like, hey, we're going to come visit. And they're like, yeah, no, you're not. Zoom him.
So something you said there, Judd, really important. As a former college coach myself, and obviously at Gill Athletics, we care about the sport of track and field. We would love to be having track meets and things right now. But as someone personally whose passion is the person of a coach, the person whose profession is coaching track and field, I think you hit the nail on the head there about using this time to double down on family time, double down on personal health time. There's been a huge upswelling on Facebook specifically, but of professional development, you know, trading ideas and thoughts amongst coaches. And that's awesome. Love that. That needs to be going on regardless of coronavirus time or not. But
right.
Using this time away from the job of coaching track and field and working on the person with their family and financial and personal health, man, that is so important right now. You hit the nail on the head there for sure.
Yeah. And everyone's giving back in every way that they can. You know, we, as coaches, we all share the same toolbox. So if I tell you what drill I do or what my thought is in the weight room, or, you know, exercises that we do and heavy hammers and light shot puts, you've got the same toolbox. It's really going to come down to your personal flair and how you implement and develop and motivate your kids. And that can't be duplicated. And so that's, you know, that I think that's why everyone's realized that it doesn't hurt to share, and it actually makes you a better coach for you to have an opportunity to talk about your philosophy.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of those tools, and it's a tool that maybe a lot of people don't think about. And you talked about this in the motivation side of it and how you train your kids and how you use the aspect that you have at your specific program is culture. And as we thought about this interview with you, Judd, from the outside looking in, the culture of Ashland Track and Field seems to be, well, first of all, it's definitely envious. I know people are envious of the culture you've built there, but it seems like it is a culture of intensity and improvement and winning. I'd like to have a discussion about your thoughts of the culture there, maybe explain what you, being on the inside, what is that culture? How did you build it? Was it conscious? Start talking to me about the culture of Ashland Track and Field.
Well, my light giver in life was a 1972 Olympian by the name of Al Schotterman. And what I mean by light giver, Mike, is somebody that can illuminate a wider space around you than you can potentially see for yourself. I was MAC champion. I qualified for one NCAA championship. I was in college in the 80s. I was I loved track, but I was partying too much. I wasn't given you know, I wasn't given an Olympian type effort because I didn't know what that was. He came my senior year in January, and he changed my culture. And he told me that if I would give him the next 2 years of my life, and that I would give up this job, I would get married, because that's going to, you know, give me some solidarity and some commitment. And if I would just buy in for the next 2 years, that he said, I can take you from number 22 in the United States to the top three, and I'll put you on that team. And so a lot of the culture that I brought to Ashland, the positive mentality, the intensity, I learned from Coach Schotterman. And
well, let me ask, because so what Coach said there, a lot of coaches have said, and maybe honestly, they could do it as well. When you think of some other great coaches of the, you know, the Mouses and Pat Henrys and Robert Johnsons, just off the top of my head, they have probably, I can imagine that they have told an athlete or two, hey, if you will just listen to me, just give me 2 years. You had to make the decision, though, to actually do it. Many kids are given that opportunity and not, and don't accept it. What was it to you that made you say, okay, let me give it a shot. Let me give up the partying and all the other stuff, and let me give it a shot. And if it doesn't work, okay, move on or whatever. What triggered for you to actually do it?
I think it was the culture that I grew up in. You know, I went around town as a 8 to 10 year old boy, and every restaurant that we went in, all the eyes were diverted to my father. He was an All-American at Ohio State, played for Woody Hayes, played 2 years with the Green Bay Packers before he hurt his knee. My brother Jeff was the number one recruited tailback in the country. You know, I had Joe Paterno, Woody Hayes, all of these great coaches coming in my house, talking to my brother. And my brother Jeff eventually ended up at Ohio State. And I remember him calling home saying, Dad, I don't know if Ohio State's the right place for me. There's this guy in front of me that's pretty good by the name of Archie Griffin. And so his first 2 years, Archie won two Heismans. And then my brother was the heir apparent. His junior year, rushed for 1,300 yards, was on the Heisman list. And so there was this culture of success in my family. And I knew that you know, some of the choices I made in college and got what I got caught up in wasn't really honoring how we were raised or how we were brought up to be the ultimate achievement, whether it was sports or not. My brother Whitney is a financial analyst, and he didn't do sports in college, but he went on to be one of the most successful businessmen in the Columbus area. And he honored that legacy. My brother Andy played football at Kent State and tied a guy by the name of Neon Deion Sanders for 12 interceptions his senior year in college, and then had a cup of coffee with the Cincinnati Bengals. And so he's a sporting goods owner now. And so we've all, my sister is the rock of the four boys. She's our calming point. She's our biggest cheerleader. She's someone that, with my mom being in a home now, and my father having passed away 3 years ago, she's kind of the calming influence on all of us. But I just made a decision to go all in. And, you know, I got a job at a YMCA working 4 hours a day. And my wife took on a lot of the burden. And I just realized that if she was going to do that for me, then I was going to have to make the most of my time. And I remember training 3-4 hours a day, coming home exhausted, and, you know, moving all the way up to, you know, top 10 in the United States going into 1984. And I said to Coach Schotterman, so how are we going to make this jump to the top three? And he said, we're going to work harder. And I said, I don't know if I can give you any more hours. He said, oh, it's going to be half the hours. This whole last year was your base training. Now we're going to start working 2 hours. We're going to start focusing in on the peaking process, and you'll break the American record in May, and then you'll go out to the Olympic trials in June and make the team. And all of that came true. 244.7 at the Jesse Owens meet in Columbus. I went out to the Olympic trials by myself with Coach Schotterman, but no family, because I was so clear that I was going to make the team that I knew my family couldn't afford to go to LA twice. I said, you wait for the games. They're like, what if you don't make it? And I said, that's not an option.
Don't worry.
Yeah, don't worry about it. So I went out to LA and, made that team. But that process and then starting to travel in 1985 and 1986 and going to the Goodwill Games in Moscow and Germany and, you know, visiting all the countries, I became a sieve for just grabbing all the information that I could. And then when Bill Gallagher called me about the Ashland job because they had just lost their coach, I wasn't willing to leave North Canton. So I commuted and I said, I'll do it for a year till you can find a coach. But this isn't something I don't think I want to do. After 6 months of being at Ashland, I said, don't hire anyone else. I want this job. And I would have worked for Bill Gallagher forever. He was just as good a man as you could ever be. He loved Ashland. He loved everything about it. And then when he decided to get out, the president asked me if I wanted to be head coach. And I said, boy, I don't know. That's a lot of responsibility. And he said, well, just so you know, if we hire another head coach, he gets to pick his throws coach. I said, you got yourself a head coach.
Motivation.
Again, 6 months later, I can't believe that I've done anything else my whole life than be head coach, because now I can fully implement the culture across the team instead of just in my own throws group. And yeah, and that's one of passion. I'll take passion over talent any day. Passion and talent makes champions. The kids that are willing to work when the coach isn't there, we have a saying, champions are made when no one's watching, but championships are won when everyone's watching. And so that's the mentality we have. The second one is that you can be good, you can be better, or you can be the best. But the key is good, better, best. Never rest until your good gets better and your better gets best. And so just some cliche little quotes that we try to live by. And then the most important thing about culture is surround yourself with people that can do what you can't do. I've had some great coaches. I had, a litany of coaches over the years, but I'll talk only about my current staff with my associate head coach, Ernie Clark. Wow, what a help in me going to the national meet and scoring 40 points in the throws and not getting on the podium. And now having a Miles Pringle and a Trevor Bassett and a 308 4x4. And I think he had five guys provisional in the 200 this year. And he's creating this culture and he's bringing in the type of athletes that can add to the throws group. We've actually downgraded the amount of scholarships we put in throws to a manageable level that I can still get who I want, but I need to be able to give him more, because he's done such an incredible job. And then Jake Sussman is our cross country and distance coach. And then Abby Majeski, who was a 5'11 and a half high jumper, won a national title for us, is our jumps and multis coach. Oh, wow. So she understood the culture. Ernie's raising the culture and he's pushing me to be a better head coach than I've ever been. And I couldn't have won that national title without him.
Yeah, we were blessed to have Ernie early in the podcast. So if you want to learn more about the Ashland program, definitely go back a few episodes and check out Ernie Clark's journey to Ashland, which seems like it was just predestined for him to get to Ashland here in his story, and definitely has a lot of good times and value that he's brought to your program there. When you are talking about what you said earlier, a little bit about with Coach Schotterman and with your wife, it sounded a lot like you were talking about that you decided that you were going to do it for other people, that it wasn't going to be about Judd, but okay, my wife is going to take care of the homestead and my kids. Well, then I better make the Olympic team. And Al, if you're going to give me 2 years, well, then I better give that to you and drop the old habits. Seemed like the culture was starting to be built on doing it, being responsible for someone else, being, I'm not sure if I'm saying the right way.
No, I understand fully what you're saying. I built a support system around myself of things that, you know, when I look back to the college years, I kind of just got caught up in that culture and kind of alienated family and, you know, alienated a lot of family values that I had grown up with. And then I started rebuilding this support system, started having kids of my own, which makes you grow up in a hurry. I put a fabulous list of massotherapists and chiropractors and, you know, strength coaches around me that were willing to be part of my team, willing to be part of Team Logan, because you need that. You need that support system. And so in the culture at Ashland, I try to be all of those things to those kids. That, Mike, the best way to define the culture in our program, I'll never forget this. It was probably 8 years ago. And I'm pretty intense at meets, and our kids are intense. And when we hit a big throw, we're yelling, we're screaming, we're pulsing, we're creating an energy. It's why all the big D1 schools want Ashland at their meet. Kentucky's like, yes. Penn State, yes. Yes, please come. Jesse Owens, yes, please come. We need that Ashland energy. We need that environment. It makes our kids do better. And I'll never forget, we had a kid by the name of Dustin, and he was a shot putter, and he was trying to qualify for the Nationals, and his PR was 55.9, and he was going to need probably 56.6 to get to the meet.
It's a big
and we get into the last throw, and I went up and I grabbed him and I put one hand on each side of his face, and I pulled it a quarter of an inch from my face, and I said, look, think back to fall conditioning. Think back to the burpees and the truck pushes and the tire flips and how hard you've worked from this. But here's the most important thing. I need you to be special right now. And as I'm sitting there holding him, he's got his eyes locked on me. And I said, now go in and do what you're capable of. And he goes in on his last throw and throws 57 feet, qualifies for the national championship, knocks a kid from another school down a spot and out of the national meet. Mm. And the mother says 10 feet away to her son, if your coach ever grabbed you in the face like that, that would be it. I would have him fired so fast. And I hear the son say to his mom, if Coach Logan ever grabbed me in the face like he just did for his athlete, it would be the greatest moment of my life. So there's the culture.
What a difference in perspective of that moment from two different constituents there. Yeah.
It was not a moment where I was yelling at him. Right. It was a moment where I told him that I loved him and I believed in him. And I just wanted him to have his opportunity to shine. And the student athlete on the other team, he knew that. He'd been around us for years. But so the perception is, you know, sometimes that's too much intensity for me or, you know, but I'm not a yeller and a screamer in practice. I'm a motivator. And if I ever raise my voice in practice to a point where it's now become that you've done something wrong, mm-hmm. it's two or three times a year. It doesn't happen again. And the seniors take care of it. So I'm not Vince Lombardi. I'm Judd Logan, and that's an easygoing guy, and it's really hard to get on my bad side. I only ask that when you cross the doors for practice time that you give me your best effort. And Mike, I'm a huge believer in body language. You know, the kids know the only way that they're ever going to be asked to leave practice is after they make a bad throw. They go kick a shoe or throw a hissy fit. I give them one warning, tell them that's not acceptable in our program. I think how you carry yourself, win, lose, or draw, body language tells me so much about when I was competing and I would read the body language, I just started checking people's name off the list. Nope, it's not going to be him today. It's not going to be him. It's not going to be him. It's going to be me. Because they didn't have that belief in themselves, and you have to carry yourself that way.
That's interesting. When I think back to the meets, and I've been to a few of them now, where your team has been, specifically throws right now, and I want to make sure we're talking about the whole team here, but specifically with the throws, I can remember, like I can play the memories in my head several times of a kid hitting a PR or moving from third to first and the excitement and everything that goes along with it that you described. I can't, I've certainly seen enough bad throws as well, you know, not PRs, and I shouldn't call those bad throws, but, you know, not PRs and not winning throws. And you're right, I can't think of a time where a shoe was kicked or undoing the glove and throwing it. It's all positive body language, not negative body language.
Unacceptable in our program. And that was started back with the early group of athletes that I had. I inherited a great group when I came in, although they were juniors and seniors. I got kids to the national meet who had never been there. I got kids who were fifth and sixth place All-Americans to be national champions. And then I got a hold of Adrian Blewett and Jackie Jeschling Alm, all in the same five-year period. And they redshirted two different years, but they had their third, fourth, and fifth years together. Those two girls, 26-time All-Americans between the two of them, and numerous national champions, national records. Adrian's shot put record still stands as the national record. Jackie just had her hammer record broken. Of course, the weight record got destroyed about 6 years ago, and that event for women is just the craziest event to me. When I think back to Jackie throwing 67 feet, and now these girls are so many college girls over 80 feet. It just blows me away. But I always thought my legacy was going to be, I wanted to coach long enough to have the most All-Americans and the most national champions in NCAA history. And I don't know where I stand. I just actually yesterday with the new word coming out that everybody that qualified for the D2 meet is now All-American. We add five to that list, but we're now at 282 All-Americans in just the throws in my time, which averages out to over 11 a year between indoor and outdoor in just the throws, and 50 national champions, which averages out to two national champions per year over my 25 years of coaching. So those numbers, although that's the legacy I wanted, my legacy is becoming, like you said earlier, about the culture that I'm going to leave this program with someday, about my incredible coaching tree with, just Blaine Magg and the job that he did at Grand Valley,
Michigan
State, now at Finley, Zach Ball over at Towson State, Jeff Jockmedes at Walsh University, Steve Manns is down at Miami of Ohio. I think right now I've got 13 or 14 of my former throwers that are coaching at either Division III, Division II, or Division I. And that's a way better legacy to see the results they're doing than to keep a stupid tabulation on the amount of All-Americans and national champions. That can be something for people to discuss after I retire. But for me right now, my legacy is to instill that culture here, do our best moving forward in limited budget eras with cutbacks across every major university, track and field getting dropped at places, saddens me, baseball programs, track and field programs. And, it's just, to me, it's so knee-jerk. And I know that there, a lot of these are budgetary. I know a lot of them are to protect football and basketball, to come into Title IX compliance. And, but it still hurts. Track and field's the highest experience for any high school athlete across the United States. Has the greatest participation numbers than any other sport. And to limit those opportunities is a huge disservice. And I understand cuts have to be made, but it still saddens me.
Agreed. Absolutely. You've been at Ashland for 26 total years, head coach for 15. when you were developing the culture for your throws group, now in at, for it, when you moved over to the head coach, now you're responsible for all the groups. How did you translate that culture across distance, sprints, jumps, etc.?
I tried not to micromanage. I told them that I would love to meet any recruits that you would like me to meet. I have a pretty good track record of closing kids that are right on the brink. But I don't want to micromanage your recruits. I want you to be active. I'm not going to tell you how to run your program. I'm not going to write your weight training. I'm not going to tell you who to run or compete this weekend. My coaches have full autonomy to, I've never discussed changing a relay order with Ernie in the 5 years that he's been there because I have a premonition or whatever. I just try to be their biggest cheerleader and to give them all the resources they need to be successful. And I'll take care of the opening speeches and how we travel and what kind of culture we're going to have when we stay at hotels. I'll let them know what's expected of them. But after that, that's your group. And they have to create their own identity. And it doesn't have to mimic the throws, but we have to be under one umbrella of knowing what we're working for, that the name on the front of the uniform is the name that we're competing for, and that's Ashland University. And the tradition, the kids that are competing today are standing on the backs of giants in the sport. You know, the Kurt Roberts, who went on to make world teams, and Brian Vickers, who just went in the Hall of Fame, was a 15-time All-American here when he was at Ashland. And then the Adrians, the Jackies, the Kibway Johnsons, all of these people that came before them, and the Katie Najat of the world, these are all Drew Wendell. These are all Ashland kids, and these are all world names that people know that came before you. And that opportunity is there for kids like a Trevor Bassett, who's now taken over the mantle for Miles as Miles moves into his professional career. And don't be shocked if Trevor Bassett ends up being top five in those 400 hurdles at the Olympic trials next year, because this kid in my 25 years of coaching has as much discipline to his training than anyone I have ever been around in 25 years. And he is exceeding what anyone would have ever thought his talent level would allow him to do through hard work and through God's gifts.
With your ability to spot talent, there's no way I'm going to doubt that premonition that you just had for that kid. That's for sure. It's interesting. I got to talk with Mr. Kibway Johnson just a few days ago and told him about upcoming interview here with you, Judd, and told him I really wanted to focus on the culture. And so I asked Kibway, I was like, what do you think? How did that culture get built at Ashland, coming from, he gets a different perspective of it than you do. And I wanted to give you what his quote was and get your feedback on how he said it. So his answer was that the culture was born, I'm paraphrasing here, so Kibway, don't get me for not quoting you word for word here, but the culture was born from the cafeteria, that it was actually after the practices and after the weightlifting sessions when the kids were all together, the athletes were all together, that is where the real culture was developed.
It's a great point. I remember one of the greatest compliments I ever got was we were at a meet at Kent State, and one of the other coaches walked up to me and he said, "Hey, great job today. Can I just ask you a question? How do you get your kids to like each other?" And I said, that culture is built outside of practice. Mm. When we finish up, being a private school, when I was at Kent State, we had 6 different cafeterias that we could go to when we were done with practice. And at Ashland, there's one main dining hall. It's ranked in the top 5 in the country for, unlimited buffet style rotisserie chickens, made to order eggs, things like that, that are just unbelievable. And dinner time at Ashland with our group of track kids is usually about an hour and a half. Kids don't want to leave. They talk about practice. They give each other grief. You know, they play tricks on each other. It's kind of like our fraternity house is the cafeteria. So yeah, that's Kibwe's spot on that. You know, that's the thing as a coach, too many coaches try to make that happen. They try to force their kids into a group and, you know, play games and try to get them to like each other and try to make them hang out with each other. That has to happen naturally. And that has to come from your leaders. There has to be in every group, somebody who's been through the program, who understands what I want, who understands that they know what they need. And to see these kids mature into those adult leaders is, to me, just as valuable of a moment for me than any All-American or national champion.
Something that you said there made me think about the saying that, you know, with culture, it's the hardest thing to build, but the easiest to destroy. What are some things that maybe you do through the recruiting process, the interview process? You have coaches that come in that from time to time in your program. Is there anything that you do to kind of make sure you weed out culture killers?
You know, a lot of our kids that we recruit grow up in the Judd Logan Olympic track and field camp. We have a 3 winter camps, and then we have a 3-day summer camp where we normally have about 250 kids. You usually have kids come in from 8 or 10 different states. Wow. You know, we order all kinds of equipment. You know, Kim and I every year at Gill, we'll have our big equipment order for the track camp to get ready for that. And we'll give, you know, things like that. We'll have a camp store and, you know, just some of that stuff that just creates that culture. But we get to know these kids. I get to start checking body language and how they treat other people when they're freshmen and sophomores. Now, I watch them mature and I give them a lot of rope. The problem is sometimes you give kids a lot of rope with it and they hang themselves. And they become unrecruitable to me regardless of talent. So I've got a pretty good eye for that kind of thing. So our camp develops, you know, I remember a kid by the name of Brent Fairbanks from Austin Town Fitch. He threw the weight 75-10 in high school with the 25, and he was ranked number 3 in the country. Jordan Geist was number 1. Jake Wickey at Kent State was number 2, and then Brent Fairbanks was number 3. All three learned how to throw the weight at the Judd Logan track and field camp. And so I ended up, you know, Geist went to Arizona, Wicky went to Kent State, and Brent Fairbanks and I had just developed this relationship. He could have gone anywhere in the United States, and his true freshman year in college, he threw 73 feet in the weight throw and was the number 1 freshman in the country, beating those other two guys by 6 or 7 feet. And so he's somebody that just bought into my culture and was looking for a private education. You know, so when we sell Ashland, we sell it on the fact that every class that you're going to ever take the entire time you're here is going to be taught by a professor. No teaching aides, no GAs. There's going to be 15 to 18 people in your class. There's going to be accountability with professors. There's going to be accountability with me. And if that's not for you, if you're like somebody who likes to sit in the back of a class and doesn't want to be accountable and thinks that it's okay to show up at practice 5 minutes late because that worked in high school, I said, please, please do not come here. You will not make it. You will be exposed by your teammates in a heartbeat and you won't make it. And so, you know, other coaches are like, would do anything just to get the kid on campus thinking you're going to be the one to change them. I lay it all out for them on the recruiting visit of what's going to be expected. And I beg them not to come if that's not what they're looking for. Now, if you are looking for accountability, if you are looking for maybe some of the greatest training partners you'll ever have in your life to push you to, you know, to these heights. We've had visits. Kibwe's come back and visited and worked with our team. Connor McCullough's come back. Sean Donnelly's come back. A.G. Krueger comes and visited. We've had Randy Barnes. We've had all of these people come and spend time with our team. You know, Drew Wendell comes back. Katie Najet comes back. And to have all of these people, you know, that are, you know, been gone or had some association to our program come back in and be willing to talk to these kids about what it takes to be the best, that just adds to the culture. But we do the weeding out process through the recruiting process.
You definitely have an amazing, not only alumni base for athletics, but like you mentioned earlier, the coaching tree alumni as well. I'm going to put you on the spot here, Judd. You don't know that I'm going to do this. So you said something there that I hear from, I bet you if I asked, I'd hear it from every coach. Okay. Without naming names, so you said that you're able to kind of weed out some of these potential, what I'm going to call culture killers, because of the amazing Judd Logan Olympic camp and things like that. Have you ever not offered a stud, someone that definitely would come in and help your program, because of something you've seen at camp or heard on their social media or something like that? No naming names here.
Yeah, I have. And I've also been burned by it. Mm. I remember recruiting a young lady, and I saw her have a blow up after a bad day with her mom, and she said some not such nice things, and I'm like, yep, we're done. And she went on to mature and be an amazing athlete in another program, became their team leader, and I'm like, boy, did I really miss on that one. Because if I'd have held myself to those standards, Judd Logan would have never been recruited to Ashland University.
Oh, so interesting.
I do have, I'm a big believer in second chances. I'm a horrible believer in third.
I'm going to quote that. I like that.
100%.
Let's move to some of these, I hate to call them infamous, but these videos, this raw intensity that you guys have in the weight room. I want to know, first of all, is that a throwers only type intensity? And then also, what do you do if you ever got a guy like me that would just not have handled that intensity at all in the weight room?
Well, what I do in the beginning is I pair everybody up with a mentor. So we've got six freshmen coming in, three girls, three guys this year in the throws program. And each of them will have a mentor, somebody who I think is going to be the one to take them from the 3 foot water into the deep end. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you need, I'm the lifeguard, but sometimes you need a swim assistant, somebody that can help them, you know, with what's expected. And so I have a mentorship program through my throws. And that intensity, the intensity in the weight room is what teaches kids how to compete. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been criticized for, you know, spending too much time in the weight room or putting too much of an emphasis on strength training in my own training and not enough throwing, not enough technical work. And that wasn't the case, because if it weren't for the weight room, I would have never found my intensity. There's just something about getting under a bar that you have no idea if you're strong enough to go up and down with it, but you've got 15 to 18 maniacs behind you telling you can.
Maniacs, yes. Yeah,
screaming and yelling with intensity. And when they do it, the look in their eyes, the breakthrough that they have, that carries over into the ring. Now, one of my former throwers who never made All-Americans, the head strength and conditioning coach here, the husband of my jumps coach, Malcolm Majeski, he's the strength and conditioning coach for the other 400 athletes here at Ashland University, other than the throwers. So he takes Ernie's group through their workouts. They've got the music blaring. They've got the same intensity going, maybe not as heavy a weights, but he knows. He was there. He was part of that throws culture. And now he's doing that with the football team. He's doing that with the sprints group. He's doing that with the jumps group. And so Malcolm's a huge asset to the university and everything that, you know, he does. But, you know, my group is my group. And so that gets some of the work off of his plate. Plus he knows it's something that I really enjoy. I've said this before in a number of talks before, Mike, and I just believe this to be incredibly true, that a bad coach that's believed in is better than a good coach who doesn't have his team.
Yes.
But then you take a good coach that has all the science, that has all the toolbox, and gets belief, man, oh, man, the results are endless of what these kids could do, what they could ever dream, because I have to have this spotlight that says, you know, what are your goals? What are your dreams? And then it's very rare that you have to temper or you have to draw them back into reality. 90% of the time, you have to say, I think you're better than that. I think you can achieve more than you think you can. And let me show you how. Let me show you where I was. Let me show you the people that came into my life that made a difference in me. Let me show you the path. Let me blaze that trail with you. And the more we stomp that trail down together, the more you'll be able to find it by yourself. So, you know, I've said this also, I don't believe that there are any great coaches. I believe that are good coaches that are blessed to have talent that give them the ability to appear as great coaches. When Roy Williams won his first national championship with Michael Jordan, they said, what an unbelievable coaching job you did this year. He goes, not even in my top five. Okay. But the talent level that he had to win and taking everything that he had learned from his career was what enabled Roy Williams to win the national title. But he had less talent in other years where they didn't win the championships, and he believed he did a better coaching job. Right, right. So I don't believe in great coaches. I mean, you don't stick Mike Krzyzewski at a 1AA school and think that you're going to win the national championship with him just because he's Mike Krzyzewski. You've got to put pieces around every coach to have success to win. And that's an ego buster for some coaches, but it's just the truth.
Yeah, I like that. There, you know, every conference in the conference championships has a coach of the year program. Typically goes to the winner, the winning team's head coach. Sometimes goes to a team that went from 10th to 3rd or something like that. There's some conference out there, maybe it's more prevalent than I realize, but I know there's some conference out there that actually gives a coaching staff instead of a coach of the year. They do a coaching staff of the year, typically to the winning team or, you know, that amazing company.
The GLIAC started it 2 years ago.
Oh, is that right? Was that the GLIAC? Yeah. I love that. That is. Yeah,
Jerry Baltus and I both believed that we were getting way too much credit.
Right.
And we've got these incredible staffs. And 2 years ago in our summer meeting, we decided to switch the award and called it the coaching staff of the year.
That is brilliant, because there is a little bit of an ego if you say, oh, yeah, yeah. And I realize the head coach does so much more. I get it. You know, you've got so much more, the administration work and paperwork and stuff like that. But it still takes your staff to do this. It just makes so much more sense to name a staff of the year instead of a coach of the year. Absolutely. Leave that to the USTCCA with their regional awards. And that makes sense, you know, assistant coaches of the year and things like that.
Yeah, but on the conference level,
absolutely. Yeah. But on the conference level, it's the staff who mentor and work with these kids. And then really it's the kids that have, you know, stepped up and won the trophy.
You know, when we started out in the GLIAC, when I think back to the schools that we had Finley, we had Tiffin, who's won multiple national championships. And a lot of those schools started to fall away because of the travel costs. And we ended up staying in the GLIAC because it's such a powerful conference. I mean, you've got Grand Valley, you've got Ferris State, you know, you've got schools like that, Saginaw Valley and some of these other schools. But we ended up being the holdout and being the school, the only school in the state of Ohio to stay in the GLIAC, whereas Malone and Walsh and Finley and Tiffin, who are in our recruiting footprint all joined the GMAC. And this week we announced that we will be moving to the GMAC after one more year in the GLIAC. And then we're going to buy out our second year and start in the GMAC conference. And what that actually does is that actually swings the power to have Ashland now in the GMAC with Tiffin and Finley and, you know, Walsh and Hillsdale. We now become the stronger track and field conference. We bring a women's basketball team that's played for the national title and won two in the last 4 years. We bring a football team that's, you know, got a 700 to 800 percentage winning. You know, so we bring a lot to the GMAC, and the GLIAC's going to be fine. Anytime that Grand Valley's anywhere, I mean, to me, they're the premier Division II program in the country. When you've got 30,000 students on campus and you can offer off-campus housing in your first year, something that we can't do, the lower cost of a state school versus a private school, their beautiful 300-meter indoor facility that they have, the what Jerry Baltus has done with that distance program, and now Matt Conley, one of my former people that worked under me, is with me, not under me, is now the throws coach at Grand Valley. And what a dynasty they have across the board. You know, they win at everything that they do.
I know JB likes competition, but I have to assume he life is a little bit easier conference-wise for him now in 2022.
it may be on the men's side. I'll tell you what, Grand Valley's women's program is so good. They scored it. A couple coaches in the GLIAC scored it. They dropped them into the MAC team. Their women's team wins the meet. You put them in the Big Ten, they finish third. I mean, their women's distance program and women's throws and jumps and
ball everything.
They're incredible. Now, my record as head coach in 15 years, having competed against Jerry 30 times, I think we've won 7 conference titles and lost 23. I think at the NCAA, we flipped that and we beat them 27 out of 30.
Really?
On the men's side.
Yeah.
Now we can't do that to them on the women's side. They're too good. So you know, he's gonna miss that level of competition with us being there. He's too much of a competitor.
Right.
But the cool thing about the GMAC is our women's team becomes relevant again with Hillsdale and Finley and Tiffin and Walsh and Malone and some of these other schools that I don't even know all the schools that are in the GMAC yet. But you know, it's gonna be good for our program. I know we're going to save about $175,000 across the board in travel and not having to go up to the Upper Peninsula and travel 12, 13, 14 hours in the middle of December with our volleyball and basketball teams. So it's a good move for Ashland.
That's awesome. And ultimately, if that's a good move for Ashland, it's a good move for the sports, each one, women's basketball, volleyball, et cetera, because it enhances competitiveness. The money savings, obviously, because then you can enrich student athletes and students of these great schools in different ways. Absolutely. And, you know, I've been on, you were talking about Ashland's dining hall, and it is famous. As a guy who has never gone to, I didn't go to school at Ashland. I know about Ashland's dining hall, but I have been on Ashland's campus for Nate's wedding. And that is a gorgeous campus, man. I really enjoyed getting a tour and seeing the entire Ashland University campus. You've got a great place there.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, they do a good job of keeping the campus up. They do a really good job of being who they are and not trying to be who they're not. You know,
boy, how important is that?
We're a private school with 2,500 students. We don't have a huge endowment. We don't graduate nuclear physicists or doctors or lawyers or architects. So we teachers and business majors and nurses and, you know, things like that. You know, we are who we are and we do what we do. We just do it well.
That's true. And, you know, you graduate people like Nate Logan, who is still one of the dearest people in my life, as him and Kim were my very first two hires at Gill Athletics. I kind of hit home runs right off the bat.
Grand slams.
Grand slams. That's it. Well, yeah. Hey, Judd, as we start to wrap it up today, I want to put your future cap on here. You're 60 years old now. Hopefully you've got, and I know you've got many, many years of coaching, however many you want to do. How have you started thinking about how or ways to protect that legacy and that culture you built once you do retire? Or is that a thought that just doesn't even come across at this point?
Well, I would, if I had a magic wand, I would certainly love to see Ernie take over the program for me when I leave. He would be able to do whatever he wants, but he has made relationships with a lot of my former throwers. Mm-hmm. I think that he'd be able to put together a heck of a staff. He'd be able to take whatever he learned from me and the twists that he's brought and taught to me and develop his own program. I also believe that there's a very good chance within the next 1 or 2 years that there's going to be a high-level Division I program come recruit him away. And at that point, when I think back at the alumni and I think back at the people that are in coaching and some that we don't even know about yet, I think that there's enough Ashland people, and it wouldn't even have to be an Ashland person that they hired, but I got to believe there'll be some connection to the staff after I leave. You know, I'll be 61 this summer. I would like to at least coach 5 or 6 more years. And at that point, what I've always said is I don't want to be coaching when I'm 80. I don't want to be that coach that stuck around and drove around in a golf cart because that's what he had in his life. I want to be able to spend some time with grandkids. I really would like to do a lot of lecturing across the United States in motivation, in telling my story, and telling some of the philosophies and creating cultures, and, you know, do 8 or 10 talks a year at universities or businesses or corporations, sit down and finally finish this book that I've been working on for about 9 years.
Tell me about that. I didn't know you were an author.
It's a book I'm writing called Betting Excellence. And it comes from a good old training partner of mine who's now with the FBI. And he had told me that when he went into the FBI, that they betted every inch of his life, like that you just cannot believe how in depth they go into finding out if you're FBI material, especially since within 2 years, he was head FBI in charge of Michelle Obama, and then eventually in charge of the entire Obama family.
Oh, wow.
He was that good.
No pressure.
And so when we had a chance to sit down and talk, I said, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. 90% of what I do is set in stone. We're going to clean, we're going to snatch, we're going to squat, we're going to jump, we're going to throw. 90% of what I do is set in stone. 90% of my time is spent trying to figure out the last 10% to make Ashland different than everybody else. And that's betting. You got to vet excellence. You have to understand what that word means. You have to understand that that comes with changes. If you would have asked me 10 years ago if I was going to be on Facebook, if I was going to be on Instagram, if I was going to be on Snapchat, if I was going to be on all these social media things, I would have told you you're crazy. Without those things, without having that adaptability and be able to talk to kids about that thing, you know, Snapchat's how I communicate to my team about any late changes in practice because they check that more than they check their email.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of adaptation, but in Betting Excellence, I tell the story about 6 steps when I vetted backwards as to how I got to where I got to as a coach and as an athlete. And that first step comes with meeting your light giver. And for me, that was, we talked about Al Shaddai.
Right, yeah.
Meeting somebody in your life that can illuminate a path greater than you can ever see for yourself. And until you meet that person, and a lot of people already have and speak fondly of that person that believed more in them than they believed in themselves. That's the start of the journey. So without giving too much away from what's in the book, that's something that has taken a back seat at times to different responsibilities that I have and with health issues and things like that. But I'd really like to have some permanency to that culture and to get it down on paper and to leave that behind as something that could withstand the test of time.
Knowing the impact that story, your story, is going to have on multiple other people, just like the coaching tree you've established, the culture of your athletes going on to become teachers and business people. I want to put one hand on each side of your face and lock you eye to eye, Judd, and tell you, get that book done. Get your story on paper to help amplify that.
That's the goal. I obviously like to get it done pre-retirement. Then I'd like to go out and speak about it because I think I've got I always wanted to do radio and TV. So anytime I get to do an interview like this, or I get to go out. And I'd rather speak in a room full of 400 than in a room full of four. So this year I've been asked to be Ashland's commencement speaker, which is the first time they've ever had a coach that's still coaching be asked to be commencement speaker. So I'm looking forward to sharing that message. It's either going to be with COVID. It's either going to be in October at the homecoming football game prior to that. Or it's going to be in December, but what an honor from Ashland.
What an honor, yeah.
To be the commencement address, but that's what I want to do. I want to get out. I want to speak. I want to share my message. And to me, that's still coaching. Even though it's not the hammer, it's not the shot put, it's not the discus, it's still coaching when you're going out and sharing with others.
I just want to expand that. You're absolutely right. You're coaching people, whether they're in the ring or outside of the ring, on how to become better people, and that affects generationally down the line. Absolutely, Judd. When you get that published, I want to be, well, I won't be first in line, because I know people like Nate and your family, they'll be first in line, but I want to be in line to make sure that I get my own copy of that for sure. Absolutely.
You got it.
If you listening today, I want to challenge you, if you're a coach or, if you're any kind of leader, and you are, whether you're a parent, you're a business person, you're a teammate for some people, I want to challenge you to really take heart what Judd said today, talking about that there are no great coaches, that, you're bound on what you do and how you do it to your team. I think that is just, right on the money. And part of that is culture. Again, hardest thing in the world to grow and build positively, the easiest thing to do to take back and destroy. One of the things that we talked about super early in today's episode, Judd, was surrounding yourself with people. And I think looking at the Ashland Eagles and how they operate at track meets, how they operate in the weight room, and I've seen them operate past school, from the Kenny Najats, Adrian Blewett's one of my favorite people in the whole world, Kurt Roberts, and of course your son, Nate Logan. That Ashland culture that you have helped develop there with your track program definitely does them positive in the world, positive in their views. I can't say thank you enough for being here today, Judd, man. This was everything I could have dreamed of this to be. I hope this just gives so much value to people who are going to listen to it and really understand that there's X's and there's O's, but there is culture that surrounds it all.
100%.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Judd. And thank you for the great update on your health, man. I'm so positive, so pumped for that. You got many, many years. I know you want to see those grandkids, but don't quit coaching just yet. All right.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Thank you, brother. Appreciate you.
Well, guys, that's it for today. Certainly hope you received as much value from this episode as we did making it. If you've made it this far, really appreciate you joining us. Your time and attention are super valuable, and we certainly don't take that lightly. And we also don't take lightly your feedback. Would you consider leaving us a rating or a comment in the app that you are using right now to listen to this episode? That would be really valuable for us. We'd really appreciate that. Want to know when future episodes of the podcast are available? The best way is to subscribe to the podcast in this exact same app. Right now, go hit that subscribe button. In the meantime, if this episode of the Gill Athletics Connections podcast provided you with value, would you consider giving that value to others in your network, sharing this episode and other episodes on your Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, smoke signals, whatever way you would like to do it? We'd really appreciate you sharing with your network and spreading the value. That's it. Really appreciate you. Can't wait to join you next time for another episode of the Gill Athletics Connections podcast.